Hello and welcome back to The Game's Gone Mad with me, Pete. It's a show where we cover the biggest footballing news and gossip from around the world, meaning today we'll be talking about the return of the Champions League, a Norwegian wonder kid who can't stop scoring, and an ex-con getting back into the professional game after his early release from prison. Ooh. The Game's Gone Mad. So today appears to be a Mean Boy special, as I'm joined by the one and only Patrick Van Straten.
Hi.
Placing the emphasis on only, as Zach Jalab has very rudely pulled out last minute, leaving Patrick and I to fend for ourselves. But I, for one, am feeling pretty optimistic about today, as now perhaps we can take the training wheels off and open this baby up for good. A real adult conversation, perhaps.
Yeah. Oh, after dark.
The Game's Gone Mad after dark. Do you remember Hollyoaks After Dark?
I did not ever watch it, but I understand that it was Hollyoaks Normal, but with...
with just slightly sexier connotations.
Money shots.
Yeah. Well, no, not in money shots, just like the the shadow of money shots. But what about you? How's your week been?
Yeah, it's been good. It's been good. I'm glad the Champions League is back. Though I think that it was quite Europa League-y, the Champions League this week. But yeah, I'm good generally. Thank you for having me, as usual. The game's gone.
So that is a pretty easy segue into our first section, which is obviously the Champions League, which returned this week. A lot of matches, not great quality.
No.
Across the board, like you said. The game I want to focus on is last night's PSG-Real Madrid game, but I feel we should probably rattle through some of the English teams first and get them out of the way. So it's been a pretty tough start for the English teams. Doesn't make us look very good. In the two episodes ago, the title of the podcast was Why English Teams Will Dominate the Champions League This Season.
Sure.
But again, you know, not the first time and definitely not the last time that Football Daily will make a horrendous cut. But to be fair, I think at least two of the English teams are pretty unlucky.
Right.
So Liverpool lost 2-0 to Napoli away. And again, I think this is a wee bit flattering to Napoli, but at the same time, Liverpool kind of only have themselves to blame.
Yeah.
Looking at the game and the chances they created, the game would have been totally different had they been able to put one away. Like, they created so many chances, and they're kind of, the only reason they lost is because, I mean, it sounds stupid, but the only reason they lost is because they could not convert. Their front three kind of seemed out of sorts. They had loads of clear-cut chances, or really, really good chances, that they just didn't capitalise on, and then they got punished because Napoli scored two late goals.
Sure, but I also think that that goes the other way as well. Like, Napoli had their chances
too.
And some of those chances are actually half chances. So there's, like, you know, the Firmino header that he puts just wide.
Again, it's tough, but it's a pretty good chance.
It's a long way out, though. Like, and just headers are just not scored from that distance very often.
But the thing is, like, if you look at the keeper's positioning, he's quite over to one side, he's flat-footed. If that's on target in that corner, that's it.
But I also think that if it just, like, bounces off the top of Firmino's head and, like, kind of, like, goes off in a random direction and doesn't just narrowly go past the post, we're not even talking about it as, like, a decent chance. Like, but, yeah.
It looks decent because he made it a decent effort.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he's put a very good effort in to turn it into a halfway decent shot, and it would have required an exceptional effort to turn it into a goal. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, yeah, when you look at expected goals for Liverpool, they had 0.8, and that seems lower than it should be because there were so many, like you say, there were so many kind of dangerous breakaway opportunities that just didn't end in a shot. So, you know, like the one where Mane overhits the ball to Salah, for instance. So not getting shots at the end of those moves is really the issue here, as opposed to not creating dangerous moves.
Yeah, but, so I think, well, with that one counted all the XG because they didn't get a shot about it.
But you do have non-shot XG. Sometimes, but like...
But that 9 times out of 10, that's got to be a goal. You know, it's a 2-on-1 on a break. All you need to do is put a weighted pass through to Salah.
I wouldn't say 9 times out of 10. I'd say maybe like 5 times out of 10, genuinely.
50-50.
I think
that's so clear-cut.
No, but I think...
At Champions League level as well.
But people do mess up those chances, especially when they've just run like half the
length
of the
pit. That was the issue I'm about to say. It was like a 60-yard run. And I think that's why the pass was so overhit. It was a tired pass.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is we're so used to seeing Mane play it perfectly and Salah knock it in as well. You know, so we think, wow, that's a huge chance. And don't get me wrong, it is a big chance, but it's not like a big chance as in, like, I thought it was a guaranteed goal. But
5 out of 10 seems low to me.
I don't know. I'll
settle in the middle for 7.
Okay, but I think the odds of these things are always lower than you think they are. Like, you always think, okay, well, that's, like, got to be a goal. People miss open goals as well. Like, I mean, fundamentally, I just think, like, I actually don't necessarily agree that this is this makes us look a little bit silly, given what we said about English clubs in the Champions League, because it's not different to last year. Like, last year, Spurs lost to Inter to start with, I think. Liverpool did lose to Napoli, and they lost to Red Star Belgrade, and those teams went on to make the final. Like, I mean, I think that this is just kind of... Going away to the Stadio San Paolo is difficult, and Liverpool were a lot better there this year than they were last year when they lost 1-0, but they were genuinely dreadful.
Liverpool also have some significant issues on the road in Europe. That was their sixth loss in eight games away in Europe, which is not a good record.
It's not good, but
considering they won the Champions League last year as well.
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, I would say they were unlucky to get beaten by as much as they did when they went away to Barcelona, but you'd expect to lose it. And also, you've got to factor in there, you know, they beat City away in the Champions League. They beat Bayern Munich away.
But at the same time, they lost the Red Star. I think they lost all their three group games away last year. And they've lost the first one this year.
But I think if you take out
Red Star
and Napoli last year, the record actually looks a lot more normal. Like this looks like
that's just taking out two losses from eight.
No, but it's taking out bad performances specifically. Right, yeah. Whereas the other games, I'd say that, like, yes, they lost, but they had quite heartening performances.
But at the same time, that is an issue in itself, given how well they performed across the board last season.
Yeah.
The fact that
definitely
when they were underperforming significantly, it was away in Europe.
But I think this season they have had some defensive issues to start the campaign. Like, it doesn't look like it because of where they are in the league, but the first couple of games they were not great defensively. Yeah. I think they were a bit luckier against Arsenal because Arsenal acted like they were playing Liverpool of last season rather than kind of saying what do Liverpool look like now. And but also, you know, the goals in this game, they're a little bit freakish. Like, one of them is like, okay, Van Dijk knocks it back a bit blind, and I think that, like, you know, on another day, Robertson's a bit more on his toes, Matip comes across, the keeper's out quicker, or Van Dijk's toe poke just happens to go more towards one than through the middle.
I don't think the issue is that it's kind of like blindsided. It's that it was in an undefined area in terms of who the recipient was. Adrian didn't know if it was his.
And there's a bit of stuttering.
So then there's that split second where both of them are saying, is that mine or is that yours?
Yeah.
But the attacker is always going to be going for that ball.
Yeah,
like, they're always, so they get that half step ahead. I think that's the reason. So I don't think it's Van Dijk's fault. I think the pass could have been better, yes, but it's also kind of like
and
an amalgamation of numerous errors.
And that just happens sometimes. It's the same way that, like, sometimes a team concedes a goal and afterwards the commentators are talking about it being calamitous defending. But what's actually happened is a defender's made a tackle and the ball has just happened to, like, collide with, like, someone's shin and, like, and
ricochet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then you look stupid because a guy's, like, running through clear through on goal. But actually what's happened is a bit of bad luck.
Yeah.
And 9 times out of 10, that doesn't happen.
And then also bad luck, I would say, for the penalty as well, in that it's not a pen. And VAR should have overturned it, in my opinion. Do you not agree?
Given the choice, I would probably not give it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's a particular problem that it was given. Like, I can see why VAR didn't overturn, because there's contact. Robertson doesn't get the ball. He basically cuts across the defender. And I feel like if it went the other way, absolutely everyone would be clamouring for this to be a penalty.
I just think the contact is so incidental that it can't be called a foul, and there's no way you can be brought down from that. There is always contact in the box. Football is a contact sport.
Sure,
there's a difference between contact and a foul.
That's true. But if you go across a player to try and get the ball and you don't get the ball and then the player goes into you, That's often given as a penalty. Mm-hmm. Is it ideal?
Is
no,
it not
but
a
is
step
it surprising?
And a half after that, and then he goes down. It's there's alleged contact just after he crosses him.
Yeah, maybe, but I mean, this is the argument we can get into as well, where, you know, sometimes a player is running through and goal, and they see the keeper coming out, and they toe poke it past him, and then go down.
Yeah.
When you say, well, they weren't going to get to the ball anyway, it's out of play. But for some reason, we kind of ignore that and say, but the keeper still fouled him. So I think the same thing's kind of applicable here. Like, the ball is basically gone, but it is pretty clumsy from Robertson. And these days, if you're clumsy in the box, you might get a penalty given against you. And Robertson knows that. He's playing aggressively.
I think the party line on VAR is that it's there to overturn clear and obvious errors from the referee.
Yeah.
And I think there is probably justification there that there's enough grey area, enough doubt there to say that it's not clear and obvious error from the referee.
Yeah,
but so therefore, because the fact the referee gave it straight away as well.
Yeah, and the VAR guys, they're going to want to watch it and be like, oh my God, like this is a catastrophic mistake. Yeah.
Yeah.
And if they can possibly get away with not overturning, they're going to not overturn.
Because you're going to have to at least keep some resemblance of referees' actual
yeah.
impact on the game and their decision, because it is their judgment calls for a lot of stuff.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, if I was a Liverpool fan, I would probably feel a little bit hard done by 2-0.
Sure.
But I mean, it's first game week. I imagine they can still top that group fairly easily.
You'd have thought so.
Yeah.
You'd have thought so. But then again, you know, they've got to go away to Salzburg as well, mm-hmm. which is no fun. And while I think they'll win all their games at Anfield, I don't know, starting with that bad loss, like, I still think they'll go through, I still think they'll win the group, but it's not actually as easy a group as it looks, just because there isn't, like, a European, like, giant in there.
And moving on to Chelsea, a team that was in a kind of group that is of similar level teams, and then one team is probably a wee bit under. They've managed to lose to that probably fourth-place team at home, 1-0 to Valencia, mm-hmm. which is not a good result, in my opinion. I don't, no disrespect to Valencian fans out there, you're not a fantastic team.
No.
And Chelsea, I think, should have won this 2-0.
Yeah, and to be fair to them, everything pointed to them winning it 2-0. Like, if the penalty had gone in, they'd have been fine. I think, well, I don't know. Well, I suppose they might not have got a winner yet. But on another day, like, one of these shots goes in early doors. They had three times as many shots as Valencia had. And while the shots they gave up to Valencia are actually kind of above average quality, like, you'd still expect them to get the win. So Valencia had 0.9 XG from 8 shots, which is above average in quality. Like, the quality of shot they're getting is pretty good.
0.13.
It's genuinely, like, pretty decent.
Yeah.
You know, and you kind of think, okay, well, this to me is the story of Chelsea season. Like, they're outshooting opponents, and they're generally the better side in pretty much every game they play. But the shots they give up are just a fraction better than they should be. And every now and then they give up a truly big chance. Mm. And there are defensive issues to be solved.
So while they're playing well, attackingly, the shots are giving up are high caliber chances.
Yeah.
And therefore, I mean, that means against any decent team, you're like, you run the risk of shipping 1-2 goals every game.
Yeah.
And which makes it difficult.
When you think that they play, when you think about teams like, say, Bournemouth or West Ham, in the Premier League this season, I think that those sides might be quite interesting against Chelsea, because I think Chelsea will create chances for themselves.
Well, just based on how direct they are.
Based on how good they are at creating high-value opportunities. Mm. Given that if Chelsea are giving up high-value opportunities to, let's be honest, a pretty ropey Valencia side right now, I'm not saying they're huge chances, and they still only gave up under one expected goal. Like, it's still good. They had all the ball. But I think that if they were playing you know, a full flight Marcelino Valencia from last season, they'd have had more trouble. And I think if you were playing a team like West Ham that has a truly elite striker on the front end of it, then it could be
it was
a
really, really weird sacking that.
Yeah. Marcelino. Well, it almost happened earlier in the summer because there were issues behind the scenes with Marcelino. And actually, they thought about it midway through last season when they were going on a bad run. And to their credit, they decided to keep Marcelino while, say, Sevilla sacked.
Yeah. But then they won the Copa del Rey.
Yeah, which was weird. I don't know. It just seemed, this kind of actually happened with Marcelino before at Villarreal. Like, eventually fell out with the board behind the scenes. But I think Marcelino's a really good manager, and the situation must have been untenable to let him go, because he is clearly a good coach. Yeah. And but I don't know. This is a lucky result for them. And to be honest, I still look at this group and I think Chelsea should win this group.
But at the same time, that blows that group wide open. I think Chelsea going into that, they'll be banking on 3 points there. Nothing else but 3 points from that first game at home to probably the worst team in that group.
Yeah, probably.
That's
maybe
that game in any group, that game you have to win. Home to the worst team.
Yeah. But I'd also look at it and I'd be like, you know what? We were the better side. And I'd also look at Ajax versus Lille, which ended 3-0 to Ajax, but on expected goals was pretty much even. Mm. I think it was like 1.6 to 1.5 or something. Like, that was Ajax at home against Lille. Like, like,
3-0.
Lille played them even, though, on chances. Mm-hmm. Like, when you see some of the chances for Lille that did not go in, like, Ajax got pretty lucky that, like, a free header for Osimhen goes straight at Onana. So I do think that if I were Chelsea, I'd look at that and I'd think, you know what, going away to the Amsterdam Arena is not a nailed-on loss. And at home, I would expect to beat them. And at home, I'd expect to beat Lille. And I don't know. Again, this is a group where, like, there's not a super club in it.
No.
But pretty much anybody can beat anybody in this group.
Well, I mean, that result last or on whatever night it was showed that any team can beat any team. And I'm just not confident in any of those teams topping that group or any of those teams dropping in the Europa League.
No.
Like, it's honestly, it's an absolute toss-up in terms of what team turns up on what night.
Yeah, definitely. But I think Valencia will finish bottom.
Yeah. Well,
I know, yeah. After those 3 points, it gets difficult to say, but I feel like, given the performance they put in, they're unlikely to luck in 2 points like that again.
Yeah, but I also think that now goal difference could come in to a large part in terms of that third, fourth position.
Well, it goes head-to-head, though.
Does it go head-to-head?
Yeah, so Chelsea have to not lose away at Valencia.
No, I just mean, like, just in generally, like, other teams. You know, like,
yeah.
Thinking probably most notably Valencia, Lille. I think those will probably be the two that will be fighting for third and fourth.
Yeah.
Okay. And I reckon it'll be closer than I thought it would be at the when the groups were announced.
Yeah.
Other English teams in action this week were Spurs, who surrendered a 2-0 half-time lead away to Olympiacos. And unlike Liverpool and Chelsea, I don't think they can feel that hard done by, because I think a draw is pretty much all they deserved, in
my
opinion.
Oh, max.
Yeah.
I'd say max.
Like,
they were dreadful.
They were so lucky to be up 2-0 at half-time. You know, yeah. Olympiacos came incredibly close in the kind of first half of the half.
Mm.
Probably should have been at least one up. Penalty was a penalty. You know, that's just clumsy from the defender.
But again, it's pure luck that he gets it. Like, because in a,
it's
don't get me wrong, he's running through into the box. But
yeah.
It's weird that the defender just decides to hang a foot out in midair.
Yeah, I think
what's he doing?
It's literally just reflexes. Like,
yeah,
it's your knee jerk
so
reaction
dumb.
That he goes past you. You've seen that the ball's kind of ricocheted in between you and bounce back. You're just trying to get a foot in the ball, get a toe in the ball, and get it out.
It's
and instead,
insane,
you've caught Harry Kane's ankle.
Yeah. But Harry Kane, I don't think, can score anymore except penalties. When I say this, I think people think I'm just like scaremongering, but the last 18 months, Kane has looked slightly above average as a striker in the Premier League. Only slightly.
Although, is that based on the fact that you're comparing that to him, say, 2 years ago when almost unstoppable?
No, I mean, I'm comparing this to Premier League average. Like, as in, he's literally like, he's about a .5, 5.6 expected goals per 90 player, whereas there was a period where he was like a 0.8, 0.9.
Yeah, there was a period where you're expecting him to score from open play 2 and 3.
Yeah, and
in the Premier League,
yeah,
which is outstanding.
There was a point where he looked like being probably the third best goal scorer in the world after Messi and Ronaldo. This was a couple of years ago. Like, he was genuinely up there with Lewandowski.
Yeah, probably,
and ahead
probably
of
2017.
Mbappe. Yeah, and now it's just like, now he looks like a good striker.
Yeah, well, I mean, excluding last year, I think he scored over 100 Premier League goals in 4 seasons.
Mm.
The 4 seasons before last season.
Yeah.
Which is mental.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, the longevity of scoring that amount of goals for that length of time.
Yeah.
And I can see where you're coming from in that he doesn't look to be the same threat currently.
Yeah.
Issues are is he fully fit? Has he been fully fit since the World Cup?
Sure, but if you asked me a couple of years ago, like, who's better, Kane or Aubameyang, I would have been like, wow, that's really close. Maybe I'd give the edge to Kane. Who's better, Kane or Lewandowski? I don't know, very close.
Lewandowski is another level currently, though.
Sure,
but at that point,
I'd have said very close. Whereas now, if you ask me who's better, like Aubameyang or Kane, then it's no competition. Like, it's clearly Aubameyang. He was top of the Premier League last season for expected goals and assists per 90 in a weaker side. Kane was not spectacular, even when he was fit. Like,
in a better side.
And now I look at him and I just think, yeah, you're a good striker. You're on your day a very good striker, but you're no longer like a... I don't think you're a world-class striker currently. It's possible he'll come back to it. And actually,
at 27. You know,
I think he's younger than that.
26.
But as much as I don't want Spurs to be great, like, I think I would like to see Harry Kane, like, be his best, but the days of him as a 5 shots per game, like, truly, truly elite player, I think look like being done thanks to these recurrent injuries.
Because
that's what happens. Injuries chip away at you.
And elsewhere in the group, they're in the same group as Bayern and Red Star. Is that correct?
Yes.
3-0 Bayern, I mean, at home
to
cares? Red Star.
Whatever.
Fair enough. Absolutely. No shock there. Clinical win. And
same as City, right?
Same as City, yeah. That's the next English team. And I don't really have much to say about City's game, to be honest, in that there's absolutely no shock here. Away to Shakhtar, people are like, oh, it can be a difficult place to go so far away, etc., etc., etc. But
100% pass accuracy for Rodri.
Yeah.
And Fernandinho getting tried out at centre-back. Like, it doesn't exactly scream like Pep thought this was difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, like, it was just a dominant performance. 54% possession, 18 shots, 5 on target to Shakhtar, 6-1.
At home.
Yeah.
At home. And Shakhtar are, like, not a pushover historically. But
yeah, I mean, again, it's kind of like, it is what it is. 3-0, it's exactly what I expected.
Yeah, exactly.
The XG reflect 0.4 to 2.6. Fair enough. You know, I honestly don't really care that much about this game in the fact that it is exactly what I expected it to be, and that's pretty much all I have to say on it.
Yep, agreed.
But the game that I do want to talk about is last night's PSG Real Madrid.
Sure.
3-0, absolute drubbing for Zidane's men, and they looked really, really poor, Real Madrid.
Yeah, I thought they pretty much produced nothing all game long. Like, don't get me wrong, like, I didn't actually think PSG produced that many big chances until kind of the final goal, really. But PSG clearly had control of the game.
They dominated, though. And also, this is the PSG without certainly their two biggest, probably their three biggest players. Well, yeah, at least their two, in that they're missing Neymar, Cavani, and Mbappe.
Yeah, and I think if you, you absolutely look at them in Real Madrid and you're like, who's missing the more important players? And it's 100% PSG.
Without that front three, for that first choice front three, potentially maybe Cavani could swap out for Icardi, who knows. Sure. But missing three of your four best strikers, your four best goal scorers, and still scoring three goals against a European powerhouse such as Real Madrid, who have spent £350 million this summer.
But Real Madrid haven't necessarily spent that money well. Like, yeah, I like some of the
transfers. That's a different conversation in general. The fact they're this big European giant, they spent all this money.
Yeah.
You're missing your three best players, and you still win 3-0.
And there were just areas where Real Madrid just couldn't compete. And to be honest, it's exactly the area that we've been saying forever. Like, their midfield. They've just got nothing in midfield. They were getting overrun because, there was so much kind of like muscular play from PSG's midfield with Gay, Marquinhos and Verratti, who are all pretty combative midfielders.
Gay was fantastic, I thought.
I thought he was probably man of the match. He and Juan Bernat were sensational, I thought. But
had Di Maria not scored too early on, they probably...
Yeah, but I mean...
Di Maria was also good, though.
Especially in his part in the third goal, too. But I do think that Gay provided the platform for everything that happened, because when Real Madrid needed to change the game, they just couldn't get a hold of it because they had nobody to bring on in midfield to shore things up. Whereas, you know, PSG later on, they were like, we can bring on Ander Herrera in the midfield and he's going to buzz around and be a problem.
But Idrissa Gueye's role is one of the a bit thankless in that nobody really, because he's not the one scoring goals, etc., getting assists, he probably gets a wee bit forgotten about in terms of like man of the match accolades. Yeah, but his stats are f***ing impressive in that 6 tackles, interceptions, 3 dribbles, 93% pass accuracy, 3 key passes, most in the pitch, and 1 assist.
Jesus. I mean, yeah, and I mean the other thing that's like a credit to him is this 0 shots on target for Real Madrid.
Yeah.
Which is the first time in 167 games.
Over 15 years. 15 years of Champions League games.
They haven't failed to put a shot on target in that long. And in this game they just never looked dangerous. Like there were one or two opportunities. But even the Bale one, you know, like the Bale one that he kind of juggles and it goes in, you're like,
good goal.
Yeah, but at the same time you're like, Keylor Navas is already walking off his line to collect it. I was alarmed at how toothless they looked. And actually,
if you look at the caliber of players they have as well in terms of like attacking players, Gareth Bale, Benzema, Eden Hazard, Luka Jovic, to not be able to muster a single shot on target in 90 minutes is indefensible.
But again, like, if you don't have the midfield, you don't have anything. Like if you don't have control of the game, if you can't get the ball, it does not matter. And I thought Hammers kind of really struggled to do it. Hammers was trying. Like, Hammers was doing his best. And actually, Hammers was buzzing around doing a lot of defensive work as well. Yeah. But they just could not play through the centre of the park. And, you know, people dropping back. Even Icardi was working defensively in this game. And I just looked at it and thought, you know, yes, Eden Hazard did nothing. But, like, every time he got the ball, he needed to beat three guys to get any space.
He completed 4 dribbles, but only put on 1 key pass. And 1 shot off target.
I'm not surprised, like, because it was actually a really like gritty game. Like there was a lot of niggly tackles, and I kind of wondered if we were going to see a red towards the end, just because there were so many like dirty challenges. But
yeah, I mean, there was a Vincenius came on and just binned. Who was it? He binned just completely unnecessary.
It was over on the left back. It might have been Bernat or someone, but he just absolutely cleaned someone out. And I thought, they look like a small club who've got frustrated because they're losing. But I just looked at them and I thought, I don't see how this gets rectified. Like, don't get me wrong, they can outpunch teams, and I think they will in domestic division. but I really don't see what can happen in their midfield to make things better. Unless their plan is when Ramos is fit, Ramos or Militao, who's played DM before, like one of them goes into the midfield to beef things up, which Carlo Ancelotti did at one stage.
Because I can't see Ramos going into DM.
But what do you do? Like, how do you beef things up? Like, because Kroos is a liability now. Modric is ancient.
They're going to stick with Kroos, so I think. Because I think he kind of gets away with it. And I think he's past that. I think he needs to move on.
Yes.
I think they need to look at alternatives. But I had a look at his stats looking to see like if he was actually terrible in terms of statistics. And they're actually not bad. 89 passes, second on the pitch, beaten only by Verratti. 93% pass accuracy, team high. 102 touches, again, beaten only by Verratti. 4 tackles, interceptions, and 1 key pass. You look at those stats. If you just have those stats without watching the game, you think that's a pretty decent game. Watching him, I think he's way off the pace. He's too slow. He can't cover the ground. He can't track the men. So again, he's a liability in trying to control the game with your midfield. But the stats don't... Again, there's a wee bit of disparity between stats and what your eyes see.
Well, So
I think he can kind of ride those stats a wee bit in that it gives him a wider turning point in that he's defensible, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, but I don't even think that Real Madrid think that way. Like, I actually think Real Madrid... We can say, okay, well, like, if you just look at the stats, he looks okay. If you look at the stats and the game, he doesn't look okay. I think Real Madrid are like 2 steps behind that, where they just watch the game and they're like, he doesn't look fine. But
they continue to play him there.
And he kind of looked like this last season as well. Like, it wasn't that crazy. Like, it's a step down, but it's not actually that much worse. So the thing is, if you're going to have a player like that who isn't going to give you much of anything, like defensively, or who the game's going to pass by, you have to find a way to protect him. You have to do basically what Juve did in the latter days of Pirlo and have Vidal and Pogba, who were 2 like absolute like ground-eating workhorses in front of him, like really working hard. Like Pogba was putting up like 5.5 tackles and interceptions that season, like when Pirlo couldn't move anymore. And if you want a Pjanic or a Pirlo or a Jorginho, who actually does more defensive work than that, if you want one of those guys at the base of your midfield, you just have to find a way to have tons of protection around them. And they've never done that with Kroos. They've always just been like, he'll be fine alongside Modric and Casemiro. And Casemiro must be just bored of like constantly snapping into tackles and still losing 3-0.
Yeah, he's just shuttling across all the space that Kroos isn't covering.
It's terrible. They should have just bought one midfielder.
As well. He covered so much ground just covering Kroos.
Yeah, and they just needed to buy one midfielder. Like, they have this idea of like, we only want to buy someone who's like a world-class talent. And you're like, actually, you don't need that. Like, I like that PSG this summer said, we're just going to get Gay and Herrera and they'll do a job for us. And if Real Madrid had gone and got, say, Adrian Rabiot on a free, or kept Ceballos, or kept Kovacic, like just somebody who could protect Kroos a little bit more, then you could justify a 3-man midfield with Kroos in it. But at the moment, you cannot have a system where you have Kroos plus Casemiro and the third midfielder is not also a guy who's going to defend a great deal.
So what does this mean for Real Madrid and their future? And like, is Zidane the right man? Like, looking at his record since returning to Madrid, and his win record is 43%.
Yeah, I mean,
which isn't great.
I've never really rated Zidane as a manager. I didn't rate him when he won 3 Champions Leagues, so I certainly don't rate him now.
It's hard to not rate someone when they win 3 consecutive Champions League.
Yeah, but when you watch them, you're just like, they're just not good. They're just not. They're like, they got lucky a lot, and they got luck, and it was, they got lucky
a
lot.
Time,
they should have gone out to Bayern Munich.
Large, so getting lucky 3 years in a row is
it's not that luck. Large. It's not that large. Like, 3 years in a row is basically the equivalent of 1 season, and you can get lucky for a season. Just ask Leicester. But I mean, it's. You do still have to be minimum level good, and they were still good. I'm not arguing they weren't good, but for instance, they should have been knocked out by Bayern Munich in one of those seasons where they got a couple of offside goals just allowed and a free red card against, I think it was Vidal. Like, so they got lucky there. And also, there's getting lucky in the sense of they just had extreme player talent covering for problems. So Sergio Ramos was like racing out of the back line to make tackles and interceptions. The system wasn't working really, but Ramos was just so good that it was fine. And yes, that can be your plan, but some years he's going to get those tackles all right, and some years he's going to get them mostly wrong. And I think that Zidane kind of got lucky that a lot of the flaws in his coaching were covered by just having unbelievable player talent at his disposal. And I don't think that was calculated on his part. I think that was luck.
Playing devil's advocate here, the Real Madrid fanboys would say that that's down to his man management, and that he's getting the best out of his best players, and knowing that that is enough to get them through most games in lieu of like a rigid stylistic tactical approach.
But then I think it's still weird then that you'd have a system which does pretty much rely on you getting lucky with some decisions, and that does rely on the fact that Sergio Ramos, because Sergio Ramos also then like got sent, like they also didn't have great performances in the league during that time mostly. Like, so
yeah, it relies on individuals as opposed to the collective, which is always dangerous.
And also it's just this idea of like, apparently if your man in management is good enough, players won't make mistakes, which just isn't true. Like, players will always make mistakes.
Yeah,
and,
like Virgil van Dijk, he's still a fantastic defender. He just made a bad decision last night.
And it's when they make those mistakes. Like, if they make a mistake when you're, say, like 4-0 up or whatever, then like no one cares. But if they make a mistake when it's 0-0, it's totally different. So there's luck in a load of regards. I'm not saying he's totally useless manager, but I've never really seen evidence that he's good at managing. I think if you went and put him inside of in charge of a mid-level side, you'd very quickly realise that he's probably basic, like an average manager.
Looking at the transfer window, everyone thought that this season would be Real Madrid's return to the preeminent or one of the preeminent forces in Europe.
But why did they think that? Why did they think that? The midfield is so bad. The midfield has been a problem for ages. And their midfield got worse this season. Like, their midfield, they lost people. Like, their midfield was not great last year. And since last year,
since last year,
everybody's a year older, which in Modric's case is a big year to get older. Yeah. Like, Kroos as well, when you haven't got much pace to get a year older is a big deal. And then
just look at Nemanja Matic. He's gone off a cliff.
Exactly. And then you look at Llorente went out. Okay, he went out to Atletico Madrid. Ceballos went out on loan to Arsenal. So that's not even bringing them a ton of money. And Kovacic went out to Chelsea. And so that is a huge downgrade, even just in options. Like, in this game, at least if... I'm not saying that, like... If people say, oh, well, Kovacic was never great at Real Madrid, or blah, 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 or Ceballos, oh, he's not ready yet. Just having a guy who you can come on who has fresh legs, you know, the Mkhitaryan at Arsenal principle, right? People saying, oh, Mkhitaryan isn't great. But you know what? He's better than having literally nobody in the left wing slot.
It's like PSG bringing on Ander Herrera, the absolute perfect person to bring on at that point, 75 minutes in, 3-0 up, or maybe 2-0 up at that stage. Just shore up the game. He'll do a lot of work. He'll cover a lot of ground in midfield, and he'll just break things down.
Yeah, and Real Madrid just had absolutely nothing. Yeah. Like, Real Madrid were constantly getting pressed out of the game in midfield, and they just could not pass through. And you just thought, wow, PSG looked comfortable. It actually reminded me a bit of when PSG beat Barcelona 4-0.
It was like a training game.
Yeah, it was embarrassing.
Or like a pre-season game. It was like there was no impetus.
But Real Madrid need these results, man. Like, they actually need this stuff, because like, everyone's kind of like, oh, this is great. Zidane's going to get some control from Florentino Perez. But clearly what we've seen this summer is that Zidane is no better at making like the squad building decisions than Perez. People loved it when Zidane, you know, like in the course of a summer decided like not really to sign anybody. And he was like, we're just going to stick with the squad we've got. And then they won the Champions League again. And everyone was like, brilliant from Zidane. And you're like, well, maybe it's brilliant. Maybe it's lucky. Like, maybe you get lucky that you don't get a significant injury. And now I think that we're seeing the problem with that, because the midfielders they were linked to this summer were Eriksen, who's great but probably not right for them, Pogba, who's definitely not right for them and would have been overpriced, and then Donny van de Beek, who you think, I like Donny van de Beek. Do I think he's Real Madrid quality? Probably not. Does he solve their defensive issues? No. Certainly not.
Yeah, what are they doing? None of those players are transformative in terms of their errors.
No. So I just look at them and I think, okay, like, we're still... You've spent a huge amount of money this season to get... Overall, I think you'll be better. I do think you'll be better just because, like, you know, you've got more talent in defence, you've got more talent in attack. I think Ferland Mendy is going to be a big boost, certainly defensively. But then I look at midfield and I think, yeah, you've just like signed away control. So, and do I think Zidane is clever enough to do what, say, Pochettino did last season when he had no midfielders, to devise a system that worked around that? No, I don't think he is. The game's gone
mad. May as well move on to our second topic, which is, again, still Champions League related. But it is the fantastic story of Erling Braut Haaland doing an absolute madness in football, just in general.
Yeah, like, he's on one.
Absolute madness. So he was born in September 2000, which makes him 19 years old. And on his Champions League debut against Genk, he scored a hat-trick in the first half.
Yeah.
Joining the illustrious company of Rooney and Ryle, who have also managed that. At that age, I think they're the only two people younger to score a hat-trick on their debut in the Champions League.
Okay.
And if you don't know this guy, you may have heard about him, because he is that bloke who scored 9 goals in a single game in the Under-20s World Cup in Norway's 12-0 hammering of Honduras.
Yeah.
And let me just break his stats down for a second here this year, because they are actually crazy. So in the 9 games he's played this year, he has scored 17 goals. And the hat-trick last night, or Tuesday night, was his third hat-trick this season. and it's September.
Yeah, they've scored 5 goals or more six times so far this season.
Salzburg. I think they've scored 34 goals in 7 games.
And he's got a handful of assists as well.
Yeah. He is averaging 1.9 goals per game.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's going to last, but I do think he's going to score a lot of goals.
Like, you guys spoke about him on the other podcast on Sunday Vibes Extra Time, didn't
you? Yeah, a little bit.
Well, what's your take on him?
I mean, he looks like he's got everything you'd want from a striker. Like, he's big, he's two-footed, you know, like, he got goals with both right and left against Genk. He gets loads of touches in the box, tons of shots, can dribble. I mean, like, when you hear his teammates talk about him, they say, like, we just have to foul him in training because you just can't do anything. And he's absolutely colossal. And, of course, you know, he speaks multiple languages as well, which I always like that about, like, I think this is a real advantage with Belgians and Scandinavians and Germans, which is that if they arrive at your club, they can probably fit in a little bit quicker than other people because they maybe speak, you know, 2 or 3 different languages already. This is also true of a lot of West African players. Mm-hmm. So you think, okay, well, this is an advantage. I mean,
it also kind of indicates like a base level of intelligence as well, which is always...
I'd agree, except the fact that, like, you can meet any idiot in Scandinavia and they will speak pretty good English. Like, I know
Scandinavia.
I know some really thick Dutch people as well who speak phenomenal English.
But, yeah, it gives him the choice of a lot of clubs and a lot of leagues that he could potentially move to.
Yeah.
Do we see any future ones happening, any big moves? If he continues on a similar trajectory, assuming that this 1.9 goals per game dies down a little bit, but he still maintains like an elite level of
scoring. It can drop by half and he'll still be an elite striker.
Where would he go?
Well, I mean, the obvious place is Leipzig, right? You know, Leipzig have obviously given Timo Werner a new contract, but it's got a pretty reasonable buyout. It looks like he'll go to a Bayern or a Liverpool or somebody like that. Mm-hmm. And if that's the case, or even Real Madrid, if they decide to sack off Luka Jovic. And if that's the case, then you'd assume that Leipzig are looking at Haaland and saying, you're going to be our next striker. Yeah. But
as a Timo Werner replacement.
Yeah. And I mean, that would be incredible. Like, that would be a great way to, like, pretty much lose no ground. And working with Nagelsmann might really appeal to him. We really don't know. On the other hand, given his debut at Molde by Solskjaer, and I'm sure that Man United would be interested, except for the fact that they've kind of got an elite young striker already in Rashford. So I feel like Leipzig are obviously like front runners, and Man United as well. But the team I suggested that would be kind of fun, I don't think he'll end up there under any circumstances, but the team that I thought would be fun would be like a Leicester, who have got a great striker who's old, who they'll need to move on from. And I think that Haaland would be exactly the sort of smart signing that we've seen them make in the years before they hired Brendan Rodgers. So I think that that would actually be super fun. The game's gone
mad. So moving on to your headline this week, and I've only got one, but it is a bit of a doozy, and it is that Zenit St. Petersburg re-sign Alexander Kokorin following early release from prison. So this is a story that Zenit have re-signed a player after he was released early from jail after being found guilty of hooliganism for attacking a trade ministry official with a chair and beating up a driver in October 2018.
Wow.
Sentenced to 17 months in custody, or 18 months, sorry, 18 months in custody. Got 48 caps for Russia. And he's out now, early, and back on the pitch.
Mm.
Do we agree? Should ex-cons get second chances? What's your definition of justice?
I think it really depends what they're convicted of. This is a really difficult question because of like the nature of football, and also I think it's a political philosophy question, right? Whether we believe in like, you know, a theory of justice as like retributive, or whether we think that it should be about revenge or rehabilitation. Like, those are all totally different things. And I think, like, I don't know. I feel like violent crimes, maybe you should not be playing. Obviously, in Russia, there's a bit of a special case because you can go to prison for anything or for any length of time.
But and Russia's just a bit of a madness in general.
Yeah, true. But I also... I don't know, when there's a violent crime, particularly when it's against women or something, like, it's strange to me, for instance, that I think that if a player got out of prison for, say, a sexual assault, and they rejoined a club and they were really good, I think the fans would accept it. But if they committed a crime against a child, got out of prison, then no club would touch them. And I think there's a weird double standard among people in that, like, weirdly, if you talk to people in this country, they have this like special category of crime in their mind that are crimes against children, but they don't apply those to, say, like, other violent crimes or crimes against women, for example. Like, And I think that's a really interesting idea because our legal system doesn't treat those as different. But anyway, I feel like in this case, it's totally fine. Like, it doesn't really matter to me. It sounds kind of funny that he attacked... I don't like him beating up a driver, but him attacking a trade ministry official is objectively hilarious. Generally speaking, I think that football is like the place where political philosophy goes to die.
For me, it's more like if they've served an adequate amount of time, if they've done the punishment, provided it's not that heinous a crime... and they've served their sentence or served what the system believes to be an adequate amount of sentence.
Yeah.
They've paid their penance and therefore should not be... should be given a second chance if another club wants to take a chance on them.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't hold it against them.
Yeah, I mean, again, it depends. It's kind of a case-by-case thing, isn't it?
Yeah. It's hard to put a blanket terminology on it. The game's gone mad. But moving on to anything but football, and this one is going to be... a bit quicker than usual because we are running out of time today. But I've got three topics for you, Pat. First one, Rugby World Cup kicks off in Japan with Japan versus Russia tomorrow. I doubt you'll be picking that one.
Yeah, probably not.
Saved by the Bell is set for a reunion where the much-loved high school show will see Zach Morris return as governor of California dealing with austerity.
Jesus.
That sounds absolutely hilarious. And the last one is The Guardian release an article of their top 50 comedians of the 21st century.
Ooh, I mean, Saved by the Bell.
Great show back in the day. I actually went to Zach Morris this Halloween, or last
Halloween.
That
sounds like something you'd do.
Yeah.
That sounds like something. I've completely lost interest in rugby since I was younger, like, because I played rugby. I was, like, rugby was probably my best sport, apart from maybe tennis.
Mm.
But I've completely lost interest over the last, like, 10 years, I'd say. But Saved by the Bell, that sounds...
sounds funny.
It sounds mental.
It sounds a bit weird. Should we do that?
Yeah, why not?
So... Saved by the Bell, obviously one of my favourite shows from the 90s.
Yeah.
Dealing with the pupils of Bayside High School. But they have announced that they will be doing a remake or like a reunion kind of show with returning characters as Zach Morris, A.C. Slater and Jesse Sapano. But apparently Zach Morris will be the governor for California dealing with austerity. And the logline is this. It's amazing. Listen to this. When California governor Zach Morris gets into hot water for closing too many low-income schools... he proposes they send the affected students to the highest performing schools in the state, including Bayside High. The influx of new students gives the overprivileged Bayside kids a much needed and hilarious dose of reality.
Jesus.
It's a wee bit weird, and reading that through, also kind of insensitive in terms of, like, classism.
Yeah, but that's no surprise, right? In a sense that, like, Americans don't really understand class and never have.
Yeah, but, like, it just all sounds a bit tragic. Also, like, if you knew the Zach Morris character, how is he ever getting the governor?
Well, also, what's the audience for this?
I don't know.
Is the audience for this like young people who are going to enjoy the teenagers? But then why have all these sops to them by throwing in like A.C. Slater and like Zach Morris? Like, who cares? If you just want to do Saved by the Bell, though it's not exactly high concept Saved by the Bell, it's just like a teenage sitcom set in a school. That is the concept of it.
Yeah.
Like, you can do that. It doesn't need to be called Saved by the Bell.
Nickelodeon have done that 25 times each year for the last 20 years.
Exactly. So like, what is the merit here? Like, I think their hope is just like, all that's going to happen is in the first few weeks, like a few sad old people will tune in and watch a couple of episodes and then they'll lose interest.
I think maybe is that what they want is the people who watched it in the early 90s to watch it again because it's a reunion, but they also have kids now.
Nobody watches
potentially a gateway
with their kids,
into,
man.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
No one watches anything with their kids.
I really don't know what this is meant to be. Is this just like the cast trying to get a final payout because they're all probably bankrupt?
Well, I don't know. I feel like,
although,
I feel like,
to be fair, Mario Lopez.
Yeah, I was going to say Mario.
Does a lot of stuff.
Mario Lopez has got a great career now. Yeah. Like, and I don't know. I feel like they should. If they were going to bring back one like 90s show, bring back Baywatch. Although, Baywatch was sick. They fought a crocodile in one episode.
God, love Hoff.
It was gangster. Like, Hoff was amazing.
Pamela Anderson.
It was very formative for me. Like Pam Anderson, Yasmin Bleek.
Yasmin Bleek.
She was absolutely outrageous. Like, it was a great time for hot people. Also, Jason Momoa was in Baywatch Hawaii.
Was he?
Baywatch Hawaii.
In terms of the Saved by the Bell, I actually don't know if Mario Lopez is returning. The article I read said that confirmed returning characters.
No, they won't bring back the character Slater without bringing back Mario Lopez.
I mean,
Lopez.
You would
There's
imagine,
no
but again, is that no way. I don't believe his name was mentioned, but again, yeah, it would be stupid to, in that you would just introduce a new character.
Who was Jesse Spano? Was that Elizabeth
Berkley? The curly-haired one, I can't remember her name.
Or was it Tiffany Thiessen?
No, was she not the other one?
Christ, I don't know.
Kelly Kapowski.
Kelly Kapowski.
She talking about like Baywatch levels of hot. She was Baywatch.
Mate, so was Mario Lopez. Mario Lopez. Oh, yeah. I wanted to be Mario Lopez when I watched Saved by the Bell. I was like, Mario Lopez is fit.
I wanted to be Zach Morris.
Well, that says a lot about
He's everything. At that stage, he was everything I wanted to be.
Yeah, because he's kind of like an American David Beckham.
Yeah. And he was just the floppy hair and it was
floppy blonde.
He was just an absolute piece. Nah, and also, to be fair, Mark Paul Gosselaar developed into quite a handsome older gentleman as well.
Doesn't always go that way. Doesn't always go that way.
Just like a Screech.
Yeah, sometimes there's a real decline.
Yeah. But no, he's still pretty fit.
I assume Screech is not going to come back.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, he's making some other movies. But yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie. If it does come out and get released, I will watch it. At least for one episode.
I won't.
Just to see how...
I don't think I'll search it out.
But, well, see it by the Bell.
Nah, not feeling it.
I would do it just for Mark Paul Gosselaar.
All right, we'll enjoy.
Love you, Mark. The game's gone mad. So that's all we have time for in this week's episode of The Game's Gone Mad. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review and a real review as well, because they also help.
Cheers.
And thanks very much for listening. Catch you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.